Have you practiced so long to learn to read? Have you felt so proud to get at the meaning of poems? Stop this day and night with me, and you shall possess the origin of all poems. You shall possess the good of the earth and sun. There are millions of suns left. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on the specters in books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself. I have heard what the talkers were talking, the talk of the beginning and the end. But I do not talk of the beginning or the end. There was never more inception than there is now, nor any more youth or age than there is now. And will never be any more perfection than there is now, nor any more heaven or hell than there is now. Urge and urge and urge, always the procreant urge of the world. Out of the dimness, opposite equals advance, always substance and increase, always a knit of identity, always distinction, always a breed of life. To elaborate is no avail. Learned and unlearned feel that it is so. Sure as the most certain sure, plumb in the uprights, well entreated, braced in the beams, stout as a horse, affectionate, haughty, electrical. I and this mystery, here we stand. It's a little snippet of Walt Whitman's Song of Myself that I thought of actually this morning when we were listening to Susan's piece, when she was making reference to a beginning that's before the beginning and the idea that this is also part of the idea that everything is now. A similar idea in Whitman's poem, not necessarily based on the same scriptural background as Susan was working with, but nonetheless similar. And this is also the beginning that's before the beginning. What I'm actually supposed to do at the beginning of this for the taping is to introduce myself and to give the title of the session. But this is before that. This is the beginning before the beginning. And I thought that there was the possibility, at least, that somebody might leave. So I'm going to give you three very quick propositions before we start. With introductions, and then three suggestions for a kind of exercise that I'd like to see people do in case you're interested in doing some writing this week. This is sort of about literature, but it's also about possibilities for your own writing and your own thinking about writing. First, the three propositions. Some of these are going to sound somewhat familiar from Susan's talk. First, language is messy, broken, and cracked. Second, God participates in the messiness of language. This wonderful example of David Yago for the idea of John the Evangelist as being a junker who's going off and looking for ordinary words and then polishing them up. And I thought, well, yeah, sure. John the Evangelist is a junker, so is God, right? I mean, you're looking at one of the discards. And when you look at John's gospel, you're also looking at one of the discards. God is participating in this event as well. So God participates in the messiness of language. And third, and this might be most important for thinking about things beyond scripture, other sorts of writing, that there is a certain kind of language, and let's call it art for now because we don't necessarily have a better word for it, that becomes strong in its weakness. Okay? Those are the three propositions for you to test for yourself. You don't have to take it from me, as Walt Whitman says. Filter it from yourself. The three-part exercise is pretty simple, and this is what I would suggest, and you can do it pretty much any time this week if you'd like, and maybe we can bring them together on Saturday for those of you who are here for that session. First, think of something that is difficult to describe for you. Two, try to write your way into an understanding of what makes it difficult for you to describe it. And three, describe it. Okay? It's an exercise, okay? It may not come off perfectly. But it may be worth the effort. And I think you can see, those of you who have looked at the handout, that some of the writers that we're looking at are already doing that, maybe including God. We'll leave that up in the air. Okay, introductions, and I should give the title as well for the people who are listening at home. Missing Letters in God's Name, Writing as a Realm of Grace. And my name is Sam Grauber, which is what I put on the board. Not because I'm an egomaniac, but because I thought one of the interesting turns from what Susan was discussing to what we're gonna be looking at today is by thinking about what I wanna talk about as a kind of series of names. Names are really important words, right? I mean, it's hard to think of a more important word in some ways than your name. And yet, have you ever seen a word that was weaker for trying to express what it was supposed to than your name? Right? Sam Grauber. What does that mean? Well, not a lot, probably, right? One of the things it might do is it might differentiate me from someone else named Sam, because you've got this nice little tag, Grauber, at the end, right? I think I met another Sam. Is there a Sam here? No. There is one in camp somewhere. I think it's a Samantha, though, so maybe there wouldn't be quite as much confusion on that one. But nevertheless, oh, there she is. She's upstairs. Okay, she just didn't want to raise her hand. Good. Okay, Samantha. So one of the things this can do is differentiate me from another Sam in the room, and that's helpful. This is also how language works, right? Language works by distinction. It's not just that somebody came together and invented the word chair, which would always stand for a chair. One of the things they were saying when they were saying chair, as Susan was saying, is that a chair is not a table. In some ways, that's the only way to figure out what chair means. It means it's not a table or not anything else that has a different designation within the lexicon. So one of the ways that this works is this kind of distinction. I am Sam Grauber. Sam Lirum is upstairs, okay? And so one of the things that does is distinguish us, and that's part of how language works. It doesn't necessarily say very much about me, especially if we're not in a dark room, because you can pretty easily tell that Sam is not Sam. So maybe we need to add more to this equation. If I was going to really introduce myself, maybe I'd have to say Samuel. Oh, it sounds so much more prestigious. Throw a middle name in there. John Grauber. Now that starts to become more of a story, actually. John is my father's name. He's sitting right in the back. He promised he wasn't going to talk today, but I'm going to embarrass him because I used to sit in the back of his classroom and he always would embarrass me. So, Samuel John Grauber. And so I carry my father's name within my own name. And so that name, that particular designation for who this individual is one that also carries a story. And people who know my family know that. So if they know my middle name is John, they're going to make some assumptions about who I am, who my father is. The fact that I might use this name might also say something about what kind of son I am. Grauber could take you all the way back to the ancient hills of Switzerland, I suppose, right? There is a meaning to it. We're not quite sure what it is. We think it means gravedigger. seems appropriate, right? So there's a story behind this name, actually, and as you make it a little more complex, you get a little bit more of that story. And what's happening as we're doing this, I hope you'll recognize, is that those of you who don't know me are already developing a kind of opinion of me based on the way that I'm talking about my name. We're going to add one more here. Uh-oh. Yeah? Yeah. Right? Now, what does that do?
Snot.
Yes. Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. Some of you may respond to that change in name as, okay, this is somebody with a huge ego, or a lot of insecurity, right? You really need that PhD.
Or,
thank you, Stuffy. Thank you. Okay, so I was in school for, 10 years, including a master's program before that, in order to get those three little letters. It's not worth it. No,
I thought it was pool hall, right?
Very good. If I could aspire to be Wes Creed, that would be better than a doctorate. No, so I got my doctorate recently, and one of the things that this does for you, of course, is open certain doors. Not everybody responds that it's just because you're snotty. Some people give you a lot of authority because you have letters after your name. It sets up an interesting context for a situation like this at Holden. And I actually dressed myself today as a kind of object lesson in how that works as well. This is one of the few collar shirts I brought. Right? I put this on for a reason. I tucked it in. Does not usually happen. I have a belt. Pants that used to be clean. So I'm sort of, I mean, it's still really wrinkled, as somebody had pointed out. I'm not going to go that far for an object lesson. So I did not iron it before this, but this is one of the ways that you can sort of present yourself, and in a way this image is also a kind of language. You're creating a sense of yourself, and in a crowd like this, sometimes that matters, and by this I mean a general classroom. At a place like Holden, it doesn't do much for you. They give you more authority if you wear a hooded sweatshirt, which I'll wear tomorrow. Partly because there are a lot of people in the audience who I know also have letters after their names, right? And so this isn't as big a deal. Don't think I don't know you're there. So Samuel John Graber, PhD, you could even throw doctor in, but I'm not going to do that. And I'm going to do this and go back to the name that I am most comfortable with, which sometimes I have to tell my students, you can call me Sam. One of the things that I want to point out as we're moving through that sort of progression, first of all, is that we really are doing something when we're using language, even pretty simple language, even if it's just a few words. We're creating a context, right, for how you're going to understand everything that's going to happen in this session and every session that follows, okay? And that's what I've done, and I've done it using language, okay, just by speaking to you. One of the things I'm doing by taking a step back and making sure that you call me Sam is admitting, first of all, that there's no way that I can represent myself through my name or any number of other words that I could try to use in a brief introductory period to let you know who I am. Language is not going to do that work for me. One of the things that I'm asking you to do when I step into this realm and try to humble myself a bit is to say, I can't tell you exactly who I am or why you should listen to anything that I say. And I'm asking for a kind of grace to enter in. Now, some of that is coming from you as being that kind of audience, and I assume you are. And some of it, I think, is going to have to come from God. I like to think that that's a possibility, that part of the work of the Spirit is the way that the Spirit is able to operate through our weak language. And I'm hoping that we can think a little bit about particular ways that particular sorts of language and literature can help to open itself to that kind of graceful communication. All right, so most of you anyway are not that interested in that particular word, right? Not yet anyway. But if we think about the same problem of language not necessarily being able to communicate not much with a word like the one that Pastor Eric pointed us to last night and that was reinforced this morning by Susan's talk, God. How are we going to talk about God as a name? We use it as a name as if it designated something. What does it mean? What sorts of words can we put together with this? Definitions, dictionary or otherwise, that could help us think about what this means. How do we know who God is, as Eric said? Can we do it? What sorts of things do we think of? Yeah?
Love.
Love, okay. So we've got love is a word that we put in there. And we have it on good authority that God is love, right? It's in the Bible. I hope most of us believe that.
Yes, but some people are under the impression it's also judgmental.
Okay, so we've got other language in the Bible that's maybe going to be associated with this that's hard to reconcile with this message of love. Some of it we find in the Old Testament, some of it we find in the New Testament. Lots and lots of people outside of the church have a huge, huge problem with this. You say that God is love and then you talk to me about hell. How does that work? Well, that's a problem I'm not going to be able to solve today. But we have to admit, at least, that in the background of this message of God, for most people anyway, there is a vision of eternal damnation. I hear this all the time from friends of mine who are not Christian. They don't get it. Even love is a little bit of a problem, even though you'd think love has no issues, right? It's perfect, right? Well, I love the Minnesota Vikings, right? I love ice cream, microwave popcorn, playing basketball, my dog. She's great, but she's not God, right? Although, I noticed that this is dog spelled backwards. Right. No, she's not. She's not. And even if I say I love my mother, I love my father, these are not God. And in some ways, throwing them in muddies the picture. I don't know whether it's doing more good or less good to talk about all the things I love and then say, okay, it's kind of like that. That's sort of what God is. I don't know if that works. I don't know if that works. I guess I don't trust my taste enough. I used to love some really terrible music. I recognize that now. It was awful. I loved it at the time. Pop radio in the 80s? Oh, yeah. That was good. No, it wasn't. It was terrible. It was terrible. God wants nothing to do with that. You've got this problem of God as being this name that we use, but we don't know what it is, and we have this problem of language, and I think everybody recognizes it. It's inadequate. It's inadequate to the question of what God is. We could put a million definitions behind this word, and it wouldn't do us any good. We're trapped. We're trapped in this world of language, and there's no way to talk about God. We're clinging by our fingernails, Susan says, at the edge of the fabric of language to try to get at this sort of truth. It can make us feel awfully weak. There are a couple of different ways that this has been dealt with. Any theologian or philosopher of religion worth their salt is probably going to have to worry about this problem of how God gets expressed through human language. One of the ways maybe to think about dealing with it would just be assume, and you can look on your sheet if you have it, on that first page of all of the different references, and these are all Old Testament. I took out the new ones because I sort of felt like Susan has that. We'll stick to the Old Testament. So, looking at the Old Testament, we all have all of these references to the biblical God, and one of the things I want to point out is that these are really important moments in the Bible. They're kind of famous moments. One of them was the first lesson for last night's service, Isaiah's call narrative. They're all about language. Okay, they all have to do with God using language. So it looks, on the surface at least, as if God is involved. But there's also the possibility that somebody might say, well, okay, but basically the people who wrote the scripture were sort of just lying. They were kind of making it up, the way that you write anything else, right? God can't be expressed through human language. The Bible is human language. Ergo, God does not exist in the Bible. It doesn't have authority. That's one way to reconcile that problem of how God gets expressed in language. Another way to potentially express that or deal with that issue would be to say, okay, scripture is special. Not just kind of special, really special. There is this problem of how God communicates himself through language, but somehow scripture eliminates it. This one book, this one time, language is not going to be a problem for us. Right? And uphold the scripture in that sense. Now, I uphold the scripture. I don't know if I can go that far. And I don't know if we're supposed to. I'd like to suggest a third alternative, and this is one that may also sound a little bit familiar to you. And this is that partly because we know that God, if we believe the God of Scripture in the Old Testament, is mucking around in language all the time in all these sort of complicated ways, I think we can also look to the New Testament and the testimony of Paul in his letters to the Corinthians as a way of thinking a little bit about how the brokenness of language can actually be a strength. And maybe, since not everybody, I think, has this, maybe could I get somebody to read those two passages from two different letters to the Corinthians? One was actually the sort of framework for the summer theme last year, I believe, right? Foolishness of God, or am I wrong, Carol? Was it foolishness of God last year? Okay. So one of them is for that, and one of them is for this year. And I think if we put the two together, we can sort of start to see what language of all sorts can maybe do. Does somebody want to read those? Would you volunteer to read it?
I will.
Oh, thanks, Tom.
For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to proclaim the gospel, and not with eloquent wisdom, so that the cross of Christ might not be emptied of its power. For the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the Word did not know God through wisdom, God decided, through the foolishness of our proclamation, to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks desire wisdom, but we proclaim Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength. But we do not proclaim ourselves. We proclaim Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your slaves for Jesus' sake. For it is God who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. But we have this treasure in clay jars, so that it may be made clear that this extraordinary power belongs to God and does not come from us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be made visible in our bodies.
Thanks, Tom. One of the things I think you probably notice at this point, maybe because we're keyed into it this particular week when we're thinking about language, is how much of this actually has to do with language. We often think of clay jars as a sort of description of our bodies, and it is. That's where Paul ends up. But he starts with this question of proclamation. And so what I would suggest in putting these two things together is that one of the ways that we can think about what God is doing through language is that he's saving it the same way that he's saving us. That it is broken because we are broken. And if he can save us as broken, finite human beings, he can also save our language. He can enter into that space in the same way that he shines through the cracks and the weaknesses of our own bodies, souls, whatever you want to call it. He can also shine through the cracks in our language. That at least would be a hope. Now, there's a little bit of a question then of what that would look like. Especially once you move into the realm of literature. And one of the things that I'd consider, at least, is that the same way that God is a problem and that we think about issues of love or the questions of love or the definitions of love as a way of thinking about God, we can also think in a kind of back doorway about people who deal with those kinds of abstractions, which Susan was pointing us today, that sort of dangerous terrain where it's very difficult to define what something like love is or what God is, as a way of also getting back at God. So in some ways, if I can get further away from the idea that I just love microwave popcorn in a kind of simple way, and think about love in a different way, perhaps at least this helps me to approach thinking about a God of love as something that's more powerful. And I think that's a little bit of an endorsement for why you don't just read the Bible, why it might be worth your while to read a book occasionally by someone other than the biblical writers, is partly because I really do believe that the way that we think about definitions of God or love or a God of love have a lot to do with our culture. And a lot of the language of culture is depraved. Okay? It's so fundamentally broken that it needs saving. And sometimes it takes a reader. Walt Whitman is not a Christian. I know this. I've studied him a lot. There is something in that passage that I read, and I can't quite put my finger on it because the language is a little bit broken, that is a space of grace for me when I see it. Something enters into that for me that helps me to understand a little bit more of the reality that Susan was alluding to in the Gospel of John as a time beyond time, a word that pre-exists existence, or even pre, right? And so I think I understand maybe God a little bit better because I've read Walt Whitman, which seems weird, but I think it's true. And it's partly because of the way that Whitman writes. I think he writes out of a broken language, and I think there are certain writers, maybe especially American writers, who have really embraced this as a technique. What would this look like if we were going to think about how you would find this sort of weakness, which could also be a strength in literature? Well, first of all, I think it has to be a recognition that on a pretty deep level, we can't say what we mean, ever. Susan Felch, who teaches at Calvin College, talking about a theorist named Bakhtin, says, "The world in which we live is full, rich, and open-ended, and our experiences in this world are so layered and complex that any attempt to explain them is doomed to failure." We can't say what we mean. I can't tell you what my experience is. Even the most mundane things, even explaining a chair, turns out to be something of an impossibility. You wouldn't know it from the way that most of the language floats around in this world. Ordinary language. We think we know the meaning of words, even the meaning of a word like God. We think we know. I think maybe one of the things that a really good writer can do is, first of all, find a way of admitting the impossibility of what they're trying. It's not going to work. These are weak vessels. These are clay pots. That at least seems to be maybe a useful first step to me. It's a way of giving God and the world its due. It's a complicated place. It's a layered place. How does this look then? If you actually are going to think about what this would look like in a literary project or any kind of writing, even personal writing, how do you do this? In a way, it's a paradox. You sit down to write. And then how do you recognize the fact that what you're doing is impossible? Right? It doesn't make any sense. It's paradoxical. Let me give you an example. And I'm going to do it by telling you the story of a story, which some of you may have read, but I'll ask you at the end. And it's going to involve a name. I'm going to erase this and put a new name on the board, and I'll let you guess which one it is. Okay, this story starts on a train with a New Yorker who is talking to his author friend about their life growing up in a small town in Nebraska. And as they're speaking, conversing, they decide together that there is no way that anybody who did not grow up in Nebraska can ever know what it was like to live in a small town like they grew up in Nebraska. It's impossible. But as they continue to talk, they remember a particular person that both of them knew, a mutual acquaintance. And the New Yorker accosts his author friend and asks her why she had never written anything about this character. Well, why? I'm going to have to read a little bit because these are quotes. She was an immigrant girl, and her mere name, just her name, calls up pictures of people and places and sets a quiet drama going in one's brain. The New Yorker, Jim's mind, is full of her that day as he's talking. And as he's talking about her, he makes his author friend see her again and feel her presence and revive her own affection for the woman on the prairie, who they both knew. The author's response is great, I think, which is, well, you do it, right? She's so special to you, why don't you write something? Okay, if you do it, I'll do it, she says. If you do it, I'll do it. She bribes him. And he looks out the window and he says, you know, I have to do that. I need to do that. A few months go by. The New Yorker arrives at his author friend's apartment with a manuscript. It's pretty big. Drops it on her desk. Says, I'm done. I had to start at the beginning. I had to tell all about the prairie and what it was like for me as a little boy growing up there. But in the end, this is my project on this person that was so important to me. And it's very clear at this point that Jim doesn't even know why she was important. Over the course of this narrative, there are some amazingly romantic confessions from this New Yorker who's married to someone else. He says at one point, right before he leaves for New York as a fairly young man, he says to this prairie girl, I'd have liked to have you for a sweetheart, or a wife, or a mother, or a sister, or anything else a woman can be for a man. And she responds to him, right before they're going to say goodbye, how can it be like that when you know so many people? And when I've disappointed you so, ain't it wonderful, Jim, how much people can mean to each other? At the end of this, as he sets down this large manuscript on the desk, he walks over to it and he says, it's not titled. What do you call something like that, a project like that? Well, you know, right? One name, right, goes right on the top. What is it, Paul? Antony. Antony. Leaves it for a second, he stops, and he goes back and says, what's wrong? Right? Anybody read this book?
Oh, good.
It's great. It's great. I teach it every chance I get. The kids love it. I mean, college students love this book. And I always tell them when I'm teaching it, I don't know why I love it. I teach The Great Gatsby. I know exactly why it's great. I teach Willa Cather's, My Antonia. It's hard to put your finger on what makes it so good. Really is. And I think they like that, actually. I think that's one of the things they like about it, is that it's open to them. So, if you're thinking about what's going on in this opening introduction to My Antonia, Remember again how this works. Cather starts by saying what you can't say. I can't tell the experience of living on the prairie to anyone and allow them to understand. It's not going to work. Language can't do it. I can't tell about this character, this wonderful woman, in a way that anybody would understand. And then Jim says, okay, I'll try. And he does it. And he writes, My Antonia. Now, in the end, I'm not sure what to make of this, actually. This is one of those ambiguous words. What does that mean? Anybody got any ideas? Why does he go back and put my? This is not a question I have an answer to. What do you think, Joanne? Yes.
That's his remembrance of her, his perception of her, how he understands her. It's not, perhaps, or she's not his in a possessive sense, as we think of mine, my scarf, my pen, my shirt, but it's his rendering of her as best that he can do.
Okay, so it's a step back, maybe, but not a possession?
Well, it might be, but I tend to see it less as a possession.
You've read the book, so you can speak
authority. Well, yes, I have.
Okay. Yes.
I feel it's less about possession and more about that's his memory of her. That's the way that he can possess, not the physical her, but
he's got her up
the
here.
Mental meaning of her, yeah.
Okay, the idea of Antonia, my Antonia,
and
the thing that I
don't care.
And what?
And he wrote it.
That's right. It was not Willa Cather's. How would you like to be in a contest with Willa Cather? Jeez. Yeah, right? So, mine, not yours. Okay? He wrote it. It's his writing. It's his memory. Okay? Possession? I don't know. Maybe? It's ambiguous to me. I'm not quite sure what to make of it. I don't know if that makes it better or worse to put my in front of it. Maybe it's better, maybe it's worse. I think it's another way that Willa Cather is opening her book by saying, this is going to be tricky. We're going to have to hope that something shines through the cracks in this narrative for this to work. Maybe it did, for people who read it. I'm going to read you one paragraph of this, which takes place right after the conversation that I was telling you about before he's going to New York. Maybe this works. As we walked homeward across the fields, the sun dropped and lay like a great golden globe in the low west. While it hung there, the moon rose in the east, as big as a cartwheel, pale silver and streaked with rose color, thin as a bubble or a ghost moon. For 5, perhaps 10 minutes, the two luminaries confronted each other across the level land, resting on opposite edges of the world. In that singular light, every little tree and shock of wheat, every sunflower stalk and clump of snow on the mountain, drew itself up high and pointed. The very clods and furrows in the field seemed to stand up sharply. I felt the old pull of the earth, the solemn magic that comes out of those fields at nightfall. I wished I could be a little boy again, and that my way could end there. Now, I don't know, how do you feel about that passage? I know many of you haven't read the novel, and so it's a little mean of me to pull out a passage like that, but for me, that's one of those places where something's happening. It's not just a mathematical description of the prairie. Something is somehow working. And for me, at least, it feels a little bit like reading scripture sometimes, when there's a voice that comes from somewhere else helping me with the brokenness of language. This is an endorsement for those of you who haven't read My Antonia to read My Antonia, okay? I think it's going to be in the bookstore, or at least a couple of copies are going to be coming up on one of the boats fairly soon. I also have a couple of excerpts if anybody wants to read the first few chapters, which are great. I'll put those, the couple of copies available, fair use, in the library. And then if people want to look at them, they can and decide from there. Maybe what we could do now is think a little bit about the stuff that's in front of you. And I'm curious how this will go.
Sam, can I say something about
Yes, please. Actually, let's stop, take a step back, and just open the floor for anything we've talked about up till now, and then we can maybe dig into some of the stuff that's actually on a page. Go ahead.
You said, what do you think about that passage? And I have not read the book.
Uh-huh.
But my interests are in environmental science and deep connectivity with the land people.
Yes.
And when I hear the description of the sun in the west and the moon rising in the east, I know exactly what's going on. And it has to be a full moon. because that's the only time that happens.
Yeah.
And as he describes the light coming from both sides and illuminating every chakra leaf and every tree, to me there arises in him a great sense of awe and wonder.
Mm.
And he wants his way to end there. Who doesn't want their way to end in awe and wonder?
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. What more is there? He's got to go back to New York. Can I give something else away about the story? He probably married his wife in order to advance his career. Ouch. She's a New York socialite. Ugh. It's a painful book to read for me. I always tell my students, I don't know what to make of this guy, Jim. I don't know what to do with him. You want to shake him at times. It's frustrating.
But see, that's the thing about is it. If someone were to write a book about our lives, they'd want to shake us.
Yeah. Right. And I should probably, you're right, you're so right. I should be giving Jim credit for not being a better advocate. I mean, it is a confession in a way. Oh, man. He may have made a mistake. Maybe not. Maybe there's something about writing the book and how it ends, I won't give that away, that can redeem it as a story. And that can be maybe helpful to us. Who hasn't made a bad choice? And all of us have been around long enough to have regretted something, a choice we've made. We need God for that. To save our experience, not just our souls. To allow us to go on. Because we can't stay in that sort of moment of awe. We have to keep going. Yeah. Other thoughts about what we've looked at, thought about so far?
Real quick.
Yeah, please.
You were saying that the language is broken and we can't describe in a word what God is. Could it be because God is perfect and as human, we strive to be perfect, but we are just dying to be loved for our imperfection?
Mm.
Or accepted for our imperfection.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all striving to be perfect, but we're not.
Right.
Like Jesus or God is.
Right. No. Well, maybe I should ask other people, what about this?
I ask to this that language in itself is constantly changing and evolving into itself.
So would you see that as part of the same issue, that language is changing and God isn't? Okay. Other thoughts? I mean, I guess, just sort of, and I wouldn't disagree with you, I think that's a big part of how we think about God, is the idea that he's, all of this stuff that we have to deal with, he is, in some sense, on the outside of that. But it seems to me that part of the message of the Bible is, again, that God mixes it up in a weird way. It's very hard to maintain an image of the perfect God and read the Old Testament. You don't get very far. I mean, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, now the little kid is already asking questions. Right, how is this possible? God in time? Well, how's that work? He's supposed to be eternal. He's supposed to be outside of time. He's supposed to be perfect. Things are changing in Genesis. That's why it's called Genesis. Right? What's going on? In what sense is God involved in this reality? And I don't know. I mean, you ask the exact right question, and I don't know if there's an answer to it. But part of what I do as a faithful person is hope that there's a little bit of that eternal. Now, here, in the brokenness, shining through the cracks. That's, I guess, a poetic way of answering a very good sort of analytical question. But I don't know how to deal with it. I don't know anybody who has solved it. So. Other? Yeah?
Just in a different direction, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Back to what you said about God and love, and that beautiful passage from my Antonia Antonia. He loved that place, and we're overhearing it, or we're standing behind his shoulder and able to look over his shoulder and see it. And something that strikes me over and over again about the Bible is not only are we looking over the shoulders of the people who love God and, you know, somehow being incorporated into that experience, but we're doing it across language worlds. I mean, like,
yeah.
From Hebrew to English,
Greek
to English, and it just
right.
throws me for a loop that we can even overhear the love through another whole language.
Absolutely.
It gets exciting.
Yeah. That's completely true. We're upheld. We have to be. And the only way that I referred that is that little star on that first page where it says ambiguous translation. Those are all NRSV translations, right? So it's all the same thing. Those are all places where people
Well, I don't know. This is our best guess. Okay? And part of it is this issue. It's coming from ancient languages to modern languages, from one language to another, and how in the world does this work? How is it that somebody picks up a Gideon Bible in Provo and opens it up and is saved in English? I mean, really? Truth comes through that cracked vessel? Huh? If it does, it's not just because of the book. Right? It's not just because of the book. Grace and truth. Grace and truth. Grace and truth. I don't think you can have one without the other. Yeah?
It isn't just me, at least. God, who is inexplicable that we can't find words for, but God has created us as finite creatures in such a way that we are sort of paradoxically created, where we're finite on one hand, and yet there are just not enough words to describe what it means to be a human being.
Yeah.
We can never find them.
Yeah.
We never can completely discover what that means.
Yeah. And you're right, you're right. And in a way, this is Whitman's last line that I read, right? Where a secular person is sort of saying, I'm mystery, and yet I stand on faith. He actually is almost echoing Luther. Here I stand.
Yeah.
Here I stand. I am this mystery, stout as a horse. Stout as a horse, braced in the beams, haughty, electrical. Okay? That's a secular maybe version of something that you have an inkling of. I hope that's true. I hope there's a link, that is because God created us that way.
I think the link is in the Bible, too.
Yeah,
I just think we've forgotten that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Any other sort of thoughts about what we've looked at?
Well, I've been wondering about one thing. You talk a lot about language that is broken.
Mm-hmm.
And to be broken means that at one time that was whole. But I think language was never whole.
Yeah.
Never.
That's a great... Can I ask Susan about that word again? The word, right? The word that was before. Because I recognize when I see it in John that's part of a broken language, right? But, or let's say flawed. Does that work? Then we don't assume that it was at some point not broken?
Oh, it really doesn't make that much.
It doesn't make much sense. My question is, was it ever anything else? In other words...
Was there ever anything better than something is broken?
Any? I mean, I know you were already talking sort of about this question of the word. Is there a beyond?
Well,
a language that isn't?
The language we know is, to use biblical language, is a fallen language.
Fallen.
But the mystery of the incarnation seems to me, from a Johannine point of view, is that God condescends into fallen language.
Saves it, yeah.
I mean, empties himself, like to use the Philippians image, the great kenosis, empties himself, and becomes one among us, including with this fallen language.
Yeah.
For this one to become word,
right,
enters in already to a frail, flesh, fallen existence. So if there was perfection, it's nothing we can grasp. It's nothing we have access to, I don't think.
Yeah, my favorite for this probably is going back to... He became a curse.
Yes, yes.
An epithet, right? He was a curse. That's how much. What Eric said last night. This is how. God so loved the world. This is how. This is how.
Sam,
condescends is not strong enough, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's.
But I think one way we try to do this with language in our translations is we'll put an uppercase W on the word when we want to say something other than the lowercase.
Yeah.
It doesn't do everything, but it helps us differentiate.
Right. Right. It's such a. I was wondering, how much does that really do? Right. That's right. The capital letter. Him, God, word. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know. That doesn't really necessarily solve the problem of talking about something as being broken, but...
It wasn't a problem.
No,
just wondering.
It's an interesting observation. Yeah, and maybe we just need to get past that language of perfection. As Susan says, we can't get at it anyway, right? At least here. So maybe let's just remember we have Jesus. Okay? And maybe that's enough. And we'll worry about the perfection later. Somewhere on the other side.
Didn't Jesus say, be perfect as your Father is perfect?
Yeah, when? When, right? I mean, he says, doesn't he say, call no man? Yeah, good? Only the Father is good? Again, language is odd. There's so much of it in the Bible. I do not want to denigrate that comment, because there is that language. What does it mean? What does it mean? Maybe for Christians, or at least we can think about that as being God coming into those clay pots. But that's what it means, being able to accept a kind of divine presence that's going to solve the problem that we can't solve. I don't know. I'm not sure.
I wanted to just say about that, the comment that you made earlier about in a lot of literature, and there'll be like a preface or right at the beginning, the words I'm going to use can't describe this experience or whatever.
Yes, yes.
We should have a preface to the Bible that says, you know,
yeah,
the words you're about to read can't mean everything that we want to say.
Right, right. Yes,
like,
yes.
If we could rewrite the novel now, or rewrite it now as a novel or somehow, that's what it would
right
say.
Or they do not express the opinions of NPR.
Yeah.
Or yeah, yeah, that would be good. No, it's true. It's true. And we don't get that. Maybe that's one of the reasons that we wrangle so much over Scripture. Because we all get the message, right? If you've been saved, you have the best. And that's what you take to the Bible when you read it. But we can still pull our hair out over those little passages that drive us crazy. Speaking of those sorts of prefaces, I don't think we have very much time, do we? Are we done at 11:50?
We still got
a couple minutes? Okay, well maybe let's look at these. I don't know if anybody got a chance to look at these. We had one really short poem. And again, these are sort of prefaces in the sense that, I'm sorry, what was your name?
Lindsay.
Lindsay was using it.
Like the
What's that? Oh, sorry.
Like the olive.
Okay.
I'm just adding work to my name.
Yes, that's right. That's right. PhD. I don't know. One of the things that we could think about in looking at both of these pieces, and this would be a way of not necessarily telling you to focus on one, but let everybody have a chance to read at least the short one. In what ways are we looking at writers who are doing a little bit of what Willa Cather is doing in setting herself up for failure, right? Can't do it. We're working with words and it's going to be tricky. As you were reading either of these pieces, was there a sense you were getting in the ways that weaknesses of language were sort of coming to the fore, that this was something that the writers were interested in talking about, or that particular weaknesses resonated with some of the things that maybe you try to express sometimes and have a hard time doing?
Well, I think to go to the E.E. Cummings poem.
Yeah. Should we read it for read it for the audience at home?
Sure.
Does somebody want to read the E.E. Cummings poem? This is so short. Somebody want to do it?
I'll read it.
Oh, thank you, Lindsay. Okay.
Okay. Since feeling is first, who pays any attention to the syntax of things, will never wholly kiss you, wholly to be a fool while spring is in the world. My blood approves, and kisses are a better fate than wisdom. Lady, I swear by all flowers. Don't cry. The best gesture of my brain is less than your eyelids flutter, which says we are for each other. Then laugh, leaning back in my arms, for life's not a paragraph, and death, I think, is no parenthesis. I think E.E. Cummings always exploits the weakness of language. I mean, right off the bat, any kid in fourth grade who was learning about punctuation knows that he's exploiting
good
that.
Right.
And he exploits the weakness to show the power of not necessarily the words of the language, but the feelings and the emotion.
Well, that's maybe the other side of the equation. Is there what is powerful about this poem? Is it powerful? That's a great way of sort of putting E.E. Cummings' project, is exploiting the weaknesses in order to produce a powerful response. What do we get at here? Is this resonating with, does this sort of poem resonate with people? Is this part of what we might want to think about if we're thinking about love in a kind of earthly sense? Really earthly, right?
I think he gushes and doesn't want to stop.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's part of the feeling, I think. Yeah.
I
think my dad is probably trying not to say anything really, really hard. He looked, he's struggling. He's struggling. I had a feeling that was going to come out of the back. Yeah. So dad doesn't like the poem. Yeah?
I love it.
Oh, you do? Okay.
He doesn't look like a classicist, but he's a classicist.
Okay.
He's a fantastic writer.
Yeah.
He does typically what Whitman does also, what Milton does, is just stacking these words on top of each other as if you've got enough of them pressed together without commas, they might actually say more than they can say individually.
Yeah.
There's a hymn in ELW by Brokering, and I think Brokering actually does what Cummings does. He just.
Which one is that? You're right. What?
Well,
who's got it?
Dying
the glory, dying the praise, right?
And
the mountain and the praise, yes. Yes.
Just stacks.
I love. Don't you love that part? Don't you love singing it?
Well, it's so.
It was first sung in this room.
Really? Oh, wow.
But it's very Cummings-esque in a way, or even Whitman-esque.
Yeah.
As if you could get all of those words out in a row together without punctuation, they in fact would work exponentially instead of arithmetically.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And those of you who've sung this hymn, that's kind of how it works. Right? You get to that point in the hymn and you want to jump out of your chair. You're getting so excited and you have this sort of representation of that gushing, putting it all together. Yeah, and you get to participate in it. That's a wonderful thing about singing. We don't get to read aloud enough. I think people would read more poetry if they read it aloud more often. Because that's what hymns are doing too, yeah.
Do you think that, like words, they try to describe action and emotion, feelings, but in order to understand truly what someone means, you have to experience it to get the same feelings. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because words can't really, like in other languages, like in my language, mm-hmm. there are certain words that can't describe. In English, I can't translate certain words in Hindi, and I can't translate certain words because they don't have words for that, but you feel it, but I can't describe it. But it's just like love or just like compassion or anything. You feel it and you try to describe it in words, but you just can't put it, but you're moved.
Yeah.
But
yeah, no, that's a wonderful description of a problem. I mean, I'm not good enough in Spanish. That's my only second language, and I'm not good enough in it to have that issue where I'm feeling like, if I could only say this in Spanish, right? But boy, what a great, because you can say it in another language. You already know. There's even a word for it, but it's not one that you can use in this room. Yeah. And of course, you have to ask yourself the question, and this is a mystery to me, how much of that feeling, even in a culture that all understands the same word and agrees that a chair is a chair, really? Or is my chair different than your chair? What is the level of our agreement beyond that just simple?
It depends on the function of the function of the chair in English compared to the function of a chair in another language.
Sure. But I'm even thinking about people who all speak English and say chair and think they're talking about the same thing. But goodness gracious, the person who's looking at death row is not going to look at this chair the same way, right? I mean, that's a completely different chair. You may as well have another word for it. Yeah. Right?
Do you know the hymn? It's a Lenten hymn. What language can I borrow? Yeah. Oh, Sacred Head, thank you.
Oh, Sacred Head, now wounded, yeah. Line. Right.
But to me, that's.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Too. Yeah. And we're always looking to borrow language. This is John again, right?
Yeah.
Just something. None of it's going to work, but let's check the junk bin. See if we can work that out.
Yeah.
That's great. No, it was. Well, I suppose we should close. I'm just going to give a little bit of a pitch for tomorrow because we're doing an evening one, and we're going to think a little bit about a particular problem of language, which is a pretty religious book. It's James Agee's Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, which was a project that involved both text and pictures. The famous photographer Walker Evans produced the photographs at the beginning of this book, and they're brilliant. But the project was to go and explain to the readers of Fortune magazine what it was like to be a Southern tenant farmer during the Great Depression. Talk about a word project. Well, what ends up happening is that A.G. gets lost I mean, this is one of the most sprawling narratives you're ever going to find. It's the weirdest book you're probably ever going to read, or one of them. And that's before you think about the pictures, which he says are not illustrations. They're not illustrations. They're not. It's. He realizes what we've been talking about. How do I do it? I can't do it. But he really knows he has to. We have to know what this suffering looks like, because these are people that everybody else, especially the readers of Fortune magazine, have forgotten about. How do I express that experience to people so that they'll understand it? Words that'll work. And it takes him a whole book of some of the most rambling stuff you're ever going to run into. Also pretty brilliant in places. Often very religious. Religious. There's an undercurrent of spirituality and even sacramentalism running through this book. I will provide, I don't know how many, if there's copies coming up of that book. It's an interesting one to have on your shelves, if nothing else for the pictures. But I think I may put some excerpts of A.G. that are bigger than we'll be able to read. Maybe I'll put those in the library too, in case people want to take a look at it who haven't read it. But that's for, we're actually doing that in an evening time tomorrow, hopefully so that we can look at some of the pictures. I've got some pretty bad digital versions of them, but they may be good enough to at least think a little bit about how photographs are also kind of broken language. Maybe better than words, maybe not. Different, certainly different than words. But I think that's maybe good for today. Any last thoughts? Stuffy.
Yeah, I want to know, would you send us off with something about the Twain excerpt?
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the great things about Twain is we talked about gaps in language and exploiting the gaps in order to produce meaning. One of the things that Twain is very conscious of in just about everything he wrote, but especially in Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, is the fact that audiences are going to interpret things in different ways. He's really interested in the issue of interpretation and how his readers will take things. So there are a lot of hidden jokes and barbs in that book that a lot of people, when they first read it, didn't get. And if they had, they would have been insulted. So this is sort of Twain's diabolical nature to embed, you know, things in that narrative. The chapter that we looked at is one where he's actually in a conversation between Jim the runaway slave and Huck the runaway boy, who are running away from a slave civilization for different reasons at first, but by the end of it, they're sort of running away from it for similar reasons. They're off by themselves and they're talking about language, books. And one of the things they talk about is how you interpret Solomon's. That wonderful parable of the wisdom of Solomon, that he has a situation where 10 women come to him, both claiming the same child, and he says, I'll cut it in half. And Jim has his own particular interpretation of this. And Huck has a different one. Huck says, well, I get the point. I understand why that's wise. It's a kind of joke. And Jim says, I don't get it. And the question here is, that I'd like anybody to think about, is who's right? Who's right? Is Jim right or is Huck right? Does Jim know something more about Solomon than Huck does? We may not get a chance to talk about it this week, but I will give you a little hint. Maybe we'll bring this back next week, because Walter Brueggemann is on Jim's side of the question. Okay? So if that's an authority enough for you, I think he has a PhD. You may want to go back to that text and look at it again. All right, thanks very much.